All right. Well, as always, it's a pleasure to be here. So I should acknowledge my gratitude for the rich couple whose funding is supporting me this year at the Institute, the Chulagins. And I also wanted to acknowledge my collaborators at UC Berkeley. I've been working with Raphael Busso and his postdoc Stefan and his grad students Zach Fisher and Jason Keller on some of the things I'll be telling you about, although some of them are also single authorship papers. All right. Probably most of you here are vaguely familiar with general relativity, but I thought I'd put this slide up just to remind people that we have a metric and we have a curvature that we construct from the metric involving two derivatives. And when we get the contract things the right way, we get the Ricci tensor and the Ricci scalar. There's a particular combination of curvatures, which is called the Einstein tensor, which appears on the on one side of Einstein's equation. This is a part of the curvature of space-time. And the physical content of Einstein's equation, the main equation of general relativity, is to relate that to the stress-energy tensor, T mu nu, which is also a symmetric tensor of the matter fields, with a proportionality constant involving Newton's constant, of course, because this is gravity. OK, so in order for that to mean anything to you, you have to know what the stress-energy tensor is. So this is a symmetric 4x4 matrix. Or d-dimensional in general, and would be d by d-dimensional. And in a particular inertial coordinate system, t, x, y, z, you could therefore independently select these 10 components of the stress-energy tensor. And in that particular reference frame, they have the following physical interpretation. The time-time component corresponds to the energy density, because that is the flux of time momentum, which is also called energy, in the time direction, which is also called density. Whereas these off-diagonal terms here can be interpreted either as a momentum density, the flux of momentum in the time direction, or as an energy flux in the space direction. Since this guy's symmetric, both interpretations are equally valid. And then there's this 3x3 stress tensor, which contains the space part of this. And the diagonal components have a particular name, which is the pressure in the x, y, and z directions. In the case of a material where these are negative, it has a different name, which is tension. Tension is just negative pressure. OK, now in the special case of a perfect fluid, I don't want to just restrict to this case, but just as an example, there are two parameters, rho, the energy density, and p, the pressure, which are related by whatever is the equation of state of that particular material. And in this case, each of the diagonal space ones is separately equal to the pressure of the isotropic material. So now, when we decide what is the physical content of Einstein's equation, the space-time geometries are not fixed a priori, so we have to figure out what kinds of space-times are allowed and what kinds of space-times are forbidden. Now, if we don't place any restrictions on the stress-energy tensor T mu nu, then Einstein's equation will have no physical content, because we could just let the geometry be anything you like. Just write down a space-time to your heart's content, and then just think of the Einstein equation as something you solve to get the corresponding stress-energy tensor. And if you don't mind that your stress-energy tensor has, you know, huge quantities of negative energy or something like that, then you have now a space-time that does what you want. So, for example, you want a traversable wormhole. Well, there's geometries like that where you have, you know, maybe take a short path through a topologically non-trivial region of space and end up in the Andromeda galaxy 15 minutes by your time. Or if you don't like messing with topology, you could just build a warp drive by arranging so that gravity is squishing space in front of your spaceship and making it contract and stretching it out behind you so that you end up, even though locally, from the perspective of the metric where you are, the geometry, you aren't traveling faster than light with respect to the light cone there. From the perspective of somebody watching over here, seeing how far you effectively travel, you could be going faster than light. And the worst of all, in terms of confusions, if it were real, would be time travel. You can write down a space-time metric that contains closed time-like curves, where if you went through some strong gravitational field, maybe you'd come back and intersect the same point you started at. Or you go back even farther, maybe, and kill your grandfather before you were born, thus creating the classic time travel paradox. Now, of course, people have thought of what various resolutions to what would happen if time travel were real, but maybe we don't have to worry about that if it isn't. So we want to ask, are these kinds of crazy phenomena actually possible? And this is one of those interesting back and forth things that happens in theoretical physics, where first it looks like you can't do something, and then it looks like, well, maybe you can, and then they find some flaw in that, and then you have to think about things in a more subtle way. So it goes back and forth. At the end of the day, the answer is probably going to be no. Because all of them require some kind of exotic matter, which has negative energy or something else perverse about it, which violates what you call energy conditions. And these energy conditions are normally obeyed by reasonable classical field theories. So a quick review of the types of energy conditions that people sometimes talk about in general relativity proofs. Here is perhaps the four most interesting ones. Throughout this slide, K is just going to be any null vector of your choice, and T and U are going to be any future time-like vectors of your choice, so the energy condition in order to satisfy it has to be true no matter what choice you make of those vectors. So the first one here is the null energy condition that says that the stress tensor is positive when you contract it with a null direction twice. So if you had a perfect fluid, energy condition makes sense even if you're not talking about perfect fluids, but it's just kind of useful to illustrate for intuitive purposes what it would mean if you did have a perfect fluid. It would require that the energy density plus the pressure be greater than or equal to zero. So you could have negative energy density, but then you'd need positive pressure, or vice versa. Now, the physical interpretation, as we're going to see, of this energy condition is that it's what you want to show that gravity is attractive and that it always focuses the null surfaces. Now, a slightly stronger energy condition, which is probably the one that you'd first think of if you just wanted to write down what would be a reasonable energy condition for the stress tensor, is this one, where you contract it with a time-like vector instead. So the motivation for this would just be that if you go into a particular frame of reference, you're demanding that the energy density be positive, and then because of relativity, you're demanding that this be true in every frame of reference. Now, this is equivalent to adding to the null energy condition, in the case of the perfect fluid, the constraint that rho is also positive. So this is slightly stronger, one of the main examples of something that satisfies the null energy condition but not the weak energy condition would be a negative cosmological constant, because that has local negative energy density, but for purposes of null surfaces, it doesn't change anything. So the another energy condition that people often use in proofs is the dominant energy condition. This differs in that you can pick these two time-like vectors to be different from each other, so T and U. And the hand-waving interpretation of this is that energy can't go faster than light. So if you imagine contracting with one time-like vector to mean that you're talking about energy instead of momentum, then the remaining index would be the vector indicating the flux of energy through space-time, and by demanding it be a time-like vector, you by demanding that it be positive when contracted with any time-like vector, you're demanding that that vector itself be a time-like vector. And so this places a bound. It says not only can you not have too much tension, you also can't have too much pressure, that both of those are bounded by your energy density. And finally, there's the strong energy condition, which has this kind of strange combination of the stress energy tensor and the trace of the stress energy tensor T on the left-hand side. You probably would not ever write down this combination as a particularly obvious combination if you were just thinking about stress tensors, maybe, but it has, this is the thing which happens to correspond to the time-time component of the Ricci tensor if you substitute it into the Einstein equation. So this thing governs the focusing of time-like geodesics that are near each other and says that gravity is always attractive from the perspective of time-like geodesics. Now, there are some reasonable matter fields which obey this condition, electromagnetism and Dirac fermions, but it can be violated by theories as simple as a scalar field with a non-trivial potential, as, for example, happened in the early universe during the inflationary epoch. So for this reason, the strong energy condition is not taken very seriously by cosmologists these days, but historically was regarded, had a higher reputation than it does now. But we're going to see all of these conditions are violated by quantum fields down the line. So that's part of this back and forth that one has to worry about. Now, if you have these energy conditions, my favorite one is the null energy condition, because a lot of my favorite theorems require it to prove them. So there's a variety of classical general relativity theorems ruling out traversable wormholes and warp drives, which it's a little tricky to define what you mean in a covariant way by a warp drive, since you have to specify what you're sped up relative to. But there's certain situations, like, for example, when you're sped up when traveling all the way from past infinity to future infinity, where you can provide a reasonable definition of what you mean by a warp drive and then say that it's not allowed. And there are as a theorem by Hawking that says if you start with a space-time that doesn't have any closed time-like curves in the past, given certain auxiliary technical assumptions, you can show that you can't come to form a time machine later on in the future. And another theorem is that you can't have any negative mass objects if you obey the null energy condition. This is a theorem by Penrose, Sorkin, and Woolgar. It's actually a special case of the no warp drives theorem, because in general relativity, it is it's a well-known effect called the Shapiro delay, that light, a ray of light, is slowed down if it travels near a massive object like a star. Now, if your star actually had negative mass, then instead of having a Shapiro delay, you would have a Shapiro advance. And this would mean that relative to light rays that didn't go close to the star, you would be sped up, and it would be effectively a warp drive. So why do I say it's only negative mass isolated objects? Because there is one loophole in this result, which is that it requires space-time to be asymptotically flat, not only at large distances in a space-like direction, but also at null infinity, as seen by light rays. So a loophole is you could have if you had a bubble of false vacuum that expands out at approaching the speed of light, it can hit future null infinity and ruin the assumptions of this theorem. And in fact, there are solutions like that that satisfy the null energy condition. So if you want a real positive energy theorem that forbids those kinds of things as well, then you actually need to assume the dominant energy condition. And there's a couple theorems along those lines. Ed Witten has a famous result where he proved in a much simpler way than it originally was proven by using spinner fields in general relativity. All right, are there any questions on this so far? Okay, so there's another feature of general relativity that a lot of people feel is pathological. And here the energy conditions don't help us. Here they actually make the problem worse. And this is singularities. So in the classical theory of general relativity, if you have something like a collapsing star, it can form a black hole event horizon, which is defined as the boundary of the region that is causally accessible to someone out at infinity. So this event horizon, if you fall in past the horizon, you typically find that there's some kind of singularity in the center of the black hole. Now, people wondered whether you could evade this somehow, which is why people proved singularity theorems. Another famous example is the Big Bang singularity that is present at the beginning of time in many cosmological models. So the singularity theorems were a proof that, in fact, under certain circumstances, these singularities have to form. The original Penrose singularity theorem is based on showing that light rays focus into a singularity in strong gravitational situations. Since it involves light rays, it's not surprising it uses the null energy condition. This theorem, however, requires space to be infinite. So Hawking turned it around in time and showed that you can prove there's a Big Bang singularity using this theorem, but only if our universe is open, meaning space is flat or hyperbolic. If space is closed, then this original Penrose theorem does not apply. To remedy this gap, there's also a Hawking singularity theorem, which is based on the focusing of time-like rays in a compact universe and showing that these time-like rays must converge to a singularity. But because it involves focusing of time-like things, this uses the strong energy condition. And so it does not necessarily hold during inflation. In fact, a very simple counterexample is De Sitter space, which has is compact spatially, but it contracts and then it expands. There's a bounce, and there isn't any singularity. Now, there's something often called a singularity theorem, proven by Bord, Guth, and Vilenkin. Their theorem says that inflation can't be eternal to the past. It had to have had some sort of beginning. That is, that if the universe is, on average, expanding everywhere, they showed that generic geodesics hit some kind of boundary of the space-time. This is often called a singularity theorem, but conceptually it's really quite different. It doesn't use an energy condition. It's really just a fact about geometry that would hold for every possible metric you could write down, no matter what it was. So I think of this as being in a completely different category. And it doesn't always prove that there's singularities either. It depends on the situation. Now, because the strong energy condition is violated during inflation, I think the original Penrose theorem is much more likely to be useful in thinking about the fundamental physics and what we expect to be the causal properties of a good theory. So that's what I'm going to focus on. Now, I have had a bunch of results involving focusing I've told you about, but I'm going to give a little bit more detail about the singularity theorem specifically, just to give some concrete ideas of what are the nuts and bolts that go into this kind of thing. So we're assuming the null energy condition, like I've told you several times now. We need a couple auxiliary assumptions. One of those assumptions is called global hyperbolicity. This is a restriction on the global causal structure of space-time that is what you would want in order to have a well-defined Cauchy evolution problem for evolving a hyperbolic wave equation on that space-time. In terms of what you're assuming about the geometry, it basically involves two parts. One is the assumption that there's no closed time-like or light-like curves. And the second assumption you need is that there's no effectively holes in the space-time that information can come in and out of. For example, if there is a time-like boundary or a time-like singularity in your space-time, then your evolution would not be predictable unless you could impose some kind of boundary condition at that on that time-like boundary. But space-like and null boundaries are OK, because you just think of that as the end of how far you want to evolve. OK, so the third assumption is that you have to assume that space is infinitely big. In mathematical language, that it's non-compact. Now, the theorem says that if a trapped surface forms, so that's the fourth assumption, then it's inevitable that there'll be a singularity. So I got to tell you what a trapped surface is. It's a closed d minus two-dimensional surface for which if you take this, so in four dimensions, this would be two-dimensional. And if you shoot out light rays normal to this surface, then it says that the outgoing light rays are, instead of expanding like you might expect for an outward direction, it says the gravitational field is so strong that the area is actually contracting as you move away from this surface. Now, you might ask, what do I mean by the outside of this surface as opposed to the inside? Well, you remember, I assume space is non-compact. So the outside is just defined as the direction of non-compactness. Sometimes both sides of the surface are non-compact, and then you could use either side. And it's very easy to form, have trapped surfaces in that case. Now, the way the proof works is based on the fact that attractive gravity causes the null surface to focus. So as we shoot out these light rays from every point on this trapped surface, and you can calculate the focusing of those light rays using the Reicha-Durey equation and the Einstein equation. So the lambda is what's called an affine parameter. It's a special kind of null coordinate that is that labels this null surface. It's kind of like the proper time of a time-like geodesic that measures the time experienced by that observer. So there's an analog of proper time for a null geodesic, but because it's null, it's only defined up to a rescaling. So if lambda is a valid affine parameter, then A lambda plus B is also a valid affine parameter. But you can write down equations that if you make sure they scale right with respect to rescaling lambda, then they have some physical content. So theta is now the rate at which the area is increasing per unit area with respect to the affine parameter. And if you take the lambda derivative of theta, this is a kind of second derivative of the area. So it's something about the rate of focusing. You work this out geometrically, you find that there's a term that's proportional to theta squared, and there's a term that's proportional to the shear squared, which is the rate at which these light rays shear into an ellipsoid. So there's something called the null extrinsic curvature, where theta is basically the trace part, and sigma is basically the traceless part. So these guys are automatically negative, just for geometrical reasons, because they're square. Then you also have the null-null component of the Ricci curvature tensor, which if I substitute in the Einstein equation, turns into the null-null component of the stress tensor, where K is a unit vector that's unit with respect to this affine parameter. So now, if I assume the null energy condition, the whole right side of this equation is now negative, and so I get an inequality about theta. In fact, because there's a theta squared here, you could show that theta would actually have to go to, if it starts out negative, then it actually has to go to minus infinity in a finite value of the time lambda. So what that tells you is that this light-like surface is actually compact. It's a finite size. Now, that doesn't quite get you that there's singularities yet, because there's another thing that can happen to end these this null surface. The light rays could just cross each other. And when they cross each other, they can just exit the surface of light rays. This, of course, can happen even in flat space-time, where if you just had a front of light rays and you focus them with various mirrors or something, you could just end up with them crossing each other. And that doesn't mean there's singularities in flat space-time. However, what can't happen is that if there's no singularities, is that all of the light rays intersect each other and disappear. At least one of them has to end in a singularity. And that's because of this assumption of global hyperbolicity, where which implies, among other things, that the topology of space can't change with time. So because we're assuming space is non-compact, it could not consistently evolve to a compact null surface without any singularities where the light rays just cross each other. So the conclusion of the theorem is that at least one of these light rays terminates and cannot be extended any farther. And if you then call that your definition of a singularity, then you're done. That may or may not involve the statement that curvature invariants blow up as you approach that point. Okay, so these, just to give a flavor of these kinds of focusing results, all of them involve the geometric focusing of light rays due to positive energy. So if you have negative energy, you would potentially have defocusing of light rays. So if we ignore the nonlinear terms, the Reichaderi equation relates the second derivative of the area to this stress tensor T. And so if that's negative, there's going to be defocusing. But the Penrose theorem normally applies to classical general relativity. If we ask whether we can extend it to situations involving quantum fields, it looks like we're going to run into trouble, because in quantum field theory, every local energy condition can be violated in certain states, although the negative energies have to be balanced by even larger amounts of positive energy somewhere else. So there's various examples of this. One famous one is the Casimir effect. We have negative energy between two conducting plates. There's space-times where you accelerate some mirrors, and as the acceleration changes, they emit pulses of energy that can be either positive or negative. A third example is something as mundane as a squeezed state of light, where you take the uncertainty principle for waves in electromagnetic radiation, and you just allow one of the canonically conjugate quantities to be stretched out and become more uncertain, while the other is squished and becomes more certain. Then things which can be constructed in the laboratory have negative energy densities along certain points of the wave, although it's balanced out by positive energies at other points in the phase. So the question is, can we take these negative energies from quantum field theory and use it to circumvent all of these things and make the science fiction authors happy by giving them all the things they wanted? Yes.
By it, do you mean the expectation value of the energy momentum tensor violates the condition?
So you could interpret that in either sense. The expectation value violates these things, and as a result, it is also true that the inequality would be violated in an operator equation sense. In general, if an operator equation type of thing holds for all states, then it should also hold as an expectation value equation. And vice versa, if the expectation value holds in all states, then it should hold as an operator equation. Obviously not the same thing if we're just talking about a single state. So to get some insight into this, I thought about a different thing, which is the Hawking area increase theorem. Stephen Hawking proved that the total area of the black hole event horizon is always increasing in classical general relativity. This is also a proof involving the null energy condition and focusing. In fact, the proof looks awfully similar to the proof of the Penrose theorem. But in this case, it's known that the result can be generalized to quantum situations because it's related to the second law of thermodynamics for black holes. So I started wondering whether the singularity theorem and related results might also be generalizable. So when you take quantum effects into consideration, it's no longer true that the area of black holes is always increasing. Instead, they emit Hawking radiation, which comes from just outside the event horizon, and that can cause the area of the black hole to shrink as it loses energy. Similarly, you can dump boxes of energy and systems into the black hole and dump, and then the black hole tends to grow. And what people noticed, and the first person to propose this was Bekenstein, although Hawking was the one to figure out the constant of proportionality, that there's a balance here. So the black hole behaves like a thermodynamic system. It obeys thermodynamic relations like the Clausius relation. If you think of the black holes as having an entropy that's proportional to their surface area. And then you have situations where the total entropy always increases in these Gedanken experiments. So the black hole can lose entropy, but the Hawking radiation coming out more than makes up for it. Or you dump something in, you no longer have the entropy of the system you dumped in, but now the black hole is bigger. So the generalized second law is formulated as taking the sum of these two terms. One of them is the black hole entropy, which is proportional to the area, and the other is the entropy outside the black hole of any matter system there. At least semi-classically, this is an open system because information can fall into the horizon. But nevertheless, amazingly, it appears to obey a law of thermodynamics reminiscent of that of closed systems if you include this extra area term. So the generalized second law is the statement that as we move up these partial Cauchy slices, we further up the horizon, with respect to that kind of time evolution, this generalized entropy quantity is always increasing or staying the same. This was basically my dissertation research, was proving that this holds for free or supernormalizable field theories using a light front quantization, where you quantize the field theory directly on the horizon instead of on space-like surfaces. Now, to give a little bit more details of what goes into this definition, to define the entropy outside the black hole, really we should think about a concept called entanglement entropy, which more generally is something that arises when you restrict a quantum field theory to only one region. So we can start with a Cauchy surface sigma, that space at one moment of time, and we can divide it into two pieces with an entangling surface E. Then we arbitrarily label one of them the interior and one of them the exterior. You can, even if your overall state of your system is pure, when you restrict to just one side, you now have to trace over the degrees of freedom in the complementary region, and so you have a density matrix rho. And the entanglement entropy is just defined as the von Neumann entropy minus trace rho log rho of that density matrix. Now, if you start with a pure state, it's the same on both sides. If you start with a mixed state, it might not be. Now, when you do this, you run into a little bit of trouble because, like everything else in quantum field theory, this is divergent and has some infinities associated with the short distance fields very close to the entangling surface. Fortunately, all of these UV divergences are local, so you can absorb them into the arbitrary local set of counterterms. There's a different game we can play where these counterterms become non-arbitrary. If we have a gravitational theory, then we can define this generalized entropy quantity, where now we care about this local surface term because that is the entropy associated with, for example, the event horizon. So we take the expectation value of the area, and we add to that the entanglement entropy outside. Now, the entanglement entropy has these divergences, so we have to absorb them into counterterms that depend on your cutoff scale. The leading order divergence is proportional to the area, and so that would correspond to a renormalization of Newton's constant, or rather 1 over the Newton's constant. The In general, there are also some subleading divergences which need to be absorbed into more complicated integrals along E. But morally, that's similar to this area term. So the idea is that each of these individual terms might depend on your cutoff, but you can define this so that the sum of all of them, the generalized entropy, is cutoff independent and therefore a reasonable quantity. And because of black hole thermodynamics, the hypothesis is that this is telling us something about the UV fine-grained entropy of the underlying quantum gravity system. So this suggests a possible approach for extending GR proofs to semi-classical situations where we start coupling them to quantum fields. You look for things that involve the area, and you replace them with the generalized entropy and see whether you get something that still works. So in order to do this substitution, since this theta, the classical area increase, was important, so important in these proofs, that's defined for an infinitesimal area pencil. It's defined as 1 over a times the derivative of a with respect to this affine parameter. So to form this substitution, to make a quantum expansion, capital theta, we would instead replace that area, the derivative of the area, with the derivative of the generalized entropy, which is actually the same as doing a functional derivative of the generalized entropy. So if you imagine a codimension 2 surface sigma, and we shoot out codimension 1 null surface n, we are interested in what happens as we do an infinitesimal shift of the location of this surface. Does that make sense? And it's a functional derivative as long as you make sure to scale it using the actual geometrical area instead of the coordinate area. You might wonder why we don't substitute that A with the generalized entropy, but you get horrible, awful things if you do that. So don't ask me that question.
technically or fundamentally? I won't ask you that.
Well, you get things that are clearly false.
Okay.
If you try to do the substitution. It depends on things in a much more non-local way. Because the thing you're dividing by could depend on the entropy of some star a million light years away. Yeah. So so this suggests that we might be interested in a focusing not of the area, but of the area plus the entanglement entropy outside. So we have constructed this quantum focusing conjecture that says if you take a second functional derivative of this capital theta, so now we have a second derivative of the generalized entropy, that on any given codimension 2 surface sigma, this is negative or zero. The interesting thing about this conjecture is that it's a law of space-time thermodynamics which could apply to any null surface. It's not restricted to just event horizons. So in that sense, it's a little more local since you don't have to think about what's going to happen at future infinity. And the idea is that it's suggestive that you could plug this in place of the null energy condition to prove similar results in the but in the case we have quantum fields that may violate the null energy condition. So the time machines, negative mass objects, warp drives, and so on would be forbidden, and that would also be suggestive that maybe that you can't avoid these singularities even when you take into account quantum fields. Now, of course, there's a big caveat here. There's different degrees to which you might take into account quantum mechanics. The stuff I'm talking about here is the semi-classical approximation, where we're basically doing quantum field theory on curved space-time, and then we're adding some sort of infinitesimal back reaction associated with the gravitational perturbation due to T mu nu. You could try to improve on that by, you know, doing perturbation theory, Feynman diagrams. Now, obviously, anything I would say about full quantum gravity, whereas, say, this focusing conjecture would be true, would be extremely speculative, because you'd have to figure out what you even mean by the geometrical concepts that go into this. That being said, I do think that this kind of thing would provide some sort of evidence that maybe you don't evade singularities even in full quantum gravity. But if you're too much trouble, I will retreat back to the semi-classical statements, where we kind of know what we're talking about. Now, I'm calling this a conjecture because, as a general hypothesis about all situations, it has not been proven. But we have made a lot of progress in proving it in some specific regimes that are important. So in order to prove this, first we're interested in figuring out what the structure of this quantity is. Now, because there's two functional derivatives in it, it's a bilocal quantity on the d minus two-dimensional surface that you choose to analyze it for. So it depends on both a point y and a point y prime. Now, it turns out to take the form, there's a piece that's bilocal, and then there's a contact term where you get a piece that is proportional to a delta function when the two points coincide with each other. It's obvious that this happens for the area piece, because the area is a local functional. It just depends. It doesn't have any non-local interactions between different parts of the surface. So any the area piece of this must necessarily be of the delta form. The entanglement entropy is a non-local quantity, so it can contribute to this. But with a little more analysis, you can show that in the situations I'll be talking about, it also has a piece that's a delta function. So this suggests a natural way to break this up is if we tried to take, you know, a second derivative as we push the slice forwards everywhere, we could chop it into little infinitesimal pieces, and we'd find that there are two cases. There's a case where the two infinitesimal pieces are at different values of y, and there's the off-diagonal piece, and there's the piece where they're stacked together on the same value of y. We need to prove both of these to get a statement about the second derivative. Now, the off-diagonal case turns out to be easy, because there's a property called strong subadditivity that holds for every quantum system automatically for the von Neumann entropy. It says if you have a region AB and another region BC, that the sum of those entropies is greater than or equal to the entropy of the union plus the entropy of the intersection. So this is a standard result. And if we apply it to this particular case of the null surface here, where up is this null direction, for infinitesimal A and C, it just corresponds to this off-diagonal derivative. B could be
a region AB. What is that?
It's just the union of this and this.
Okay, and so if B doesn't exist,
then this would reduce to SA plus SC is greater than or equal to SAC, which is the statement of ordinary subadditivity. This is a slightly stronger statement that allows, or a much stronger statement that allows the regions to overlap.
Okay, so yeah. It's stronger than.
That's why it's called strong subadditivity. Yeah. And this just corresponds to the sort of discretization of the second derivative if you broke it up into four terms using the sort of standard calculus thing. The diagonal case is more subtle. It has, in this case, if you consider a surface which is classically growing, then it's not all that interesting because it should just reduce to the case of the classical Reichert-Dury equation inequality. But if you consider a null surface that's close to stationary, which is just perturbed in its area and entropy by quantum fields falling across it, then you can make these be at the same order in a GH bar expansion. So even if you're treating GH bar as small, you still have a non-trivial interplay between the area piece of this inequality and the entropy piece. In this case, it turns out to reduce to an interesting statement that, as far as we know, nobody else had conjectured before about the about a pure quantum field theory without coupling to gravity. So the statement is that a quantum field theory, in order for this to be true, the quantum field theory has to obey a constraint on the null-null component of the stress energy tensor. But instead of the null energy condition that would say it's positive, it says it's greater than or equal to the second derivative of the entanglement entropy. This could be either positive or negative. So in some cases, this is stronger than the null energy condition. And in other cases, it is weaker. Now, this is a non-gravitational statement. But if you happen to turn on gravity, then the null-null component governs the second derivative of the area. So you could substitute in the second derivative of the area, move this to the other side of the equation, and you get the quantum focusing conjecture. So this means it's now a field theory statement, and we can check whether your favorite field theory obeys it or not if you're clever enough. So we did check it in some cases that were simple enough to analyze. We started with bosonic field theories with only relevant couplings. The reason for this is we were using light front quantization. And it turns out that relevant couplings are completely irrelevant for the structure of the theory on a null surface. And so you just reduce it to the free case. And the free case, we did a combination of that with the replica trick, which I don't have time to explain what is, but it's a very common method used to calculate the entanglement entropy in field theories, with a bunch of rather subtle analytic continuations. There's a reason I'm not showing you this calculation. It's kind of a mess. But at the end of the day, it proved that this inequality was true for free field theories and therefore also for these supernormalizable field theories. Another recent paper, not with me, with two of the people at Berkeley, showed that this works holographically. So they just considered theories that have a holographic dual and proved that you proved it on a statement on the bulk side, which is dual to this quantum null energy condition using ADS-CFT. But it's not proven in full generality, so there's more work to do. Another piece of evidence for this conjecture comes from higher curvature gravity. So I briefly mentioned these counterterms here. But these counterterms can be thought of as coming from the contributions of the one-loop quantum corrections to the action of general relativity. So in general, you could modify that action by adding some sort of higher curvature term, for example, some function of the Riemann tensor. Now, one thing worth checking is if we do such a modification, I don't care whether it actually comes from quantum fields or not, we could just consider an arbitrary modification. There's a procedure for deriving an entropy functional. I've written it out in null coordinates where v and u are null directions normal to the codimension 2 surface here. So there's an integral of something on the surface This piece coming from differentiating the Lagrangian with respect to the RUV-UV is called the Wald entropy and was a very famous result for the entropy associated with a black hole in higher curvature gravity theory. It's in the case of general relativity, this is what would give you the area. But it turns out that this calculation was ambiguous in cases where the black hole or other null surface isn't stationary. It's only unambiguous for a static black hole or null surface. So recently, there's been a lot of work picking out the corrections to this formula. And the next leading order corrections involves the extrinsic curvature of this codimension 2 surface in the U or V direction. That involves differentiating with respect to the Riemann tensor twice. There's still some controversy about the order k fourth and higher terms, but at least the calculation up to this point seems secure. It's calculated by things like holographic entanglement entropy, the work of Shi Dong and other people. Now, so the last little thing I want to tell you about is that you can actually show an analog of this focusing result in any higher curvature gravity theory. More precisely, if I take any metric scalar theory of gravitation, my action can have a metric, the curvature, any number of derivatives of the curvature, optionally a scalar field, one or more scalar fields and any number of derivatives of those, plus a matter sector, which I take to be boring. It's minimally coupled to the gravity and obeys the null energy condition and so on, because I'm just interested in the effects of changing this gravitational action. Then I showed that you can always construct an entropy functional that it obeys a focusing relation, specifically for linearized perturbations to the stationary case. So for a linearized perturbation, it's these extrinsic curvature squared terms turn out to be important. And so you construct this entropy functional by basically taking the null-null component of the gravitational equation, the thing that's the analog of the Einstein tensor, and I showed that you could always pull out two v derivatives out from that expression and have something left over that it acts on. So that allows you to work out the entropy, and somewhat amazingly, it turns out to actually agree in the case of F of Riemann gravity with this Dong entropy, which was worked out holographically by a completely different means. And when I say it agrees, I mean it agrees up to the order of k to the fourth terms, which I can't know anything about because they go beyond linearized order, and up to a total derivative in the transverse direction, which we presumably don't care about because we're integrating in that direction. I should also say the fact that this is at linearized order, I didn't stop just because I got lazy. There's actually a fundamental reason why this argument only works at linearized order. It's not a controlled expansion. So to wrap things up, this quantum focusing conjecture is a novel space-time thermodynamic principle. It's nice because it unifies geometry with information theory in one little package. It's more local than black hole thermodynamics, so I'm hoping that it gives more insight into what the microscopic quantum gravity degrees of freedom might be doing that generate space-time. And it's useful for extending general relativity theorems to quantum situations. I want to emphasize that in general, it's a conjecture. But in semi-classical situations where the quantum effects are small, we can reduce it to the quantum null energy condition, which is proven in many cases. And I feel like this would be an interesting condition just from the perspective of field theory, even in non-gravitational contexts. So more work is necessary to prove it for every decent quantum field theory, where, of course, we'll only learn what decent means once we find the necessary and sufficient conditions. But I do think it's interesting that quantum gravity is able to lead to some insights about flat space-time field theory that people hadn't thought of before. All right, so that's what I had to tell you. Yes.
So you were giving examples in how normal quantum effects like Casimir effects or things like this can lead to negative energies.
Yeah.
Or whatever. And in those cases, can you see how that corresponds to the entropy doing something strange such that it doesn't violate your new condition?
In certain cases, you can. It's easier, actually. So in the case of the Casimir effect you have in the lab, you have the plates, yep. Which is a very messy thing.
Sure.
What's easier is to do just conformal transformations to get to things like the Casimir effect if you compactify a dimension of space.
Yep.
And there, the especially in 1 plus 1 dimensions, you can work out the entanglement entropy and the stress tensor from the anomalous transformation properties. I did this in a paper once to analyze this kind of issue, and you find you can explicitly see this sort of focusing relation. I had that in a paper called Testing the Generalized Second Law with 1 plus 1 Conformal Vacuum, something like that.
More questions?
Yeah.
So here, these results, you were always in the context where space-time is classical. And you can delineate an interface classically in an area. So natural question is, what is the next step? You want to go beyond that, beyond this. So what are the ideas for the next
step? So even at the level of perturbation theory, of course, at a certain point, you have to start worrying about the fact that you have quantum fluctuations in your space-time geometry. And it's there it would be important to figure out some sort of covariant way of specifying the location of your surface. You better not just use coordinate locations, because otherwise, once there's quantum fluctuations, that's no longer a gauge invariant choice. So I do suspect that it would be possible to do these sorts of geometrical proofs, sort of almost Euclidean things involving locations of surfaces. I mean, like in Euclidean and axiomatic system sort of sense, even when there's these quantum fluctuations. But it's I've done many slightly hand-waving proofs along these lines. I feel like clarifying the fundamentals of what you can do and what you can't get away with would be a useful thing to do. Ultimately, of course, in full quantum gravity, we expect some of these geometrical concepts to break down. And I would hope that this generalized entropy would be connected somehow to some coarse graining of the entropy of the fine grained degrees of freedom. So I'd like to think, what is sort of reverse engineering, what is true about the microscopic degrees of freedom that would somehow imply something about the second derivative of the entropy automatically?
Okay, if not, let's thank our guest.